Well, here it is, the most famous speech in all of English literature. The problem for the actor is it's so well known that nobody bothers to listen to it when it's given. All the audience has to do is hear those first few words and go sit back and say, oh yeah, I know that one. And, oh yeah. In fact, there's the famous story, a very funny story of, again, the great Sir Tyrone Guthrie, who was opening the theater in Minneapolis, the theater that bears his name, and he opened it with an uncut Hamlet, an uncut production of Hamlet that ran about 5 hours with intermission. So it was a wonderful performance. I was lucky enough to see it, but during the run of the play, the actor playing Hamlet, a very good actor named George Grizzard, was worrying because he had the sense as he did that speech, he wasn't getting any reaction from the audience. So he complained to the director, and Guthrie said, my dear boy, don't worry about it. Nobody ever listens to that speech anyway. They think they know it. They hear the beginning of it, and they just close down for a while, and so it doesn't matter what you do. And the young actor was sort of taken aback at that and said, well, no, I'm here. It's not, they're listening to me. Guthrie said, I'll make you a bet. He said, this afternoon's matinee, when you go out there, here's what I want you to do. And Grizzard said, all right. And he said, see, if anyone comes backstage, if anyone in the cast or in the audience comments on this. And Grizzard said, okay, I'll do it. So at that matinee, he went out and said, to be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the ham and eggs of outrageous fortune. There was no response. No one commented. Nobody was listening. They'd heard the to be or not to be and just settled back in their chairs because they knew, I know that speech. Nobody ever commented. The difficulty with this speech is we simply know it too well. That opening phrase is too familiar. It's become such a part of the language. So what I want to do is go through and try to look at what it means in terms of the character, because it does have meaning. It comes in Act 3. Act 3, of course, in terms of the structure of the play, Act 3 is the center of the play. Everything that's happening in Act 3 is very important, and in fact, as this play is structured, in one sense, the climax of the action takes place in Act 3. We'll look at that. Leading up to it, we get this great soliloquy that opens the third act. To be or not to be, that is the question. The subject is suicide again. Does one continue to exist, or does one no longer continue to exist? And that's the only thing of any real importance. Please remember that thoughts of suicide began the first soliloquy in Act 1. Oh, that this too sullied flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew, or that the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter. Wish I could kill myself, but God's law says no. Please notice what has happened by Act 3. What is eliminated is God's law. And now it is simply a question of, do I kill myself or do I not kill myself? Does one commit suicide or does one not commit suicide? God's law has left Hamlet's consideration. And we are now simply dealing with an abstract question. To be or not to be, that is the question. The doubt has become so pervasive, and his own sense of this world in which he finds himself is one that is without God. This is Act 3, okay? But we're following a pattern here, and we can understand it. That sort of doubt, where everything gets doubted, where nothing seems to have any validity, has now brought him to this point. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind Okay? And we're back to the notion of there's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Is it noble to continue living? But the nobility is not based on an external, objective order of moral truth. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind. Is the mind in a position to judge the nobility of, okay, to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune? There is no pattern or purpose to life. There is only fortune, whimsy, chance. And it is outrageous. And the reason it's outrageous is because it's unpredictable, it's disordered, you can do nothing about it. There is simply the ebb and flow of accidental events. And therefore, is there any way of in the mind giving nobility to the continuation of suffering those slings and arrows that patternless existence just keeps throwing at you? Okay? Or, what's the alternative? To take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. Now, look at this closely, because the image that is used, the metaphor, is hugely important. You either just go on suffering what fortune sends to you, and try to think that you're being noble in doing so, or you take arms against a sea of troubles. Now there is a very curious thought. You've got this sea of troubles that's about to wash over you, and what do? You take up arms against it. You can't deal with a sea with a weapon. Some of you may know the old Irish myth of King Cahulain, who went out to cut the heads off the waves, okay? And I don't know if Shakespeare knew that or not. It's possible. It's an old, old standing Irish story. But of course, King Cahulain can't do it. He loses. What happens? It washes over you. There's no way you're going to beat the waves or knock the heads off the waves. Can't do it. Or to take arms against the sea of troubles and by opposing, end them. End what? The sea of those troubles. How do you end them by going after the sea with a weapon and attacking them? You're just overwhelmed. Do you win? No. But by attempting to oppose the sea, you finally put an end to your troubles. And the vision is of what? You're just finally swept away. You just go under. Or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, and to make it clear, notice the next two words. To die. To die. To sleep. No more. What does it mean? Death is no more than sleep. Death is like sleep. We go to sleep every night, we lose consciousness, so what's the worry about death? It's no more than that. To die, to sleep, no more. And by asleep, to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. Finally, you put an end to all that pain. Finally, you put an end to the thousand natural shocks. It's bombardment, okay? As long as you're alive, that flesh is heir to one thing, just one being hit time and time again. We can understand, as we've been following through the play, why he says that. What has his life been since we see him? It's just been one thing after another, smashing him. And the point is, you come eventually to say, enough, enough, that's it, let's stop this. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. Consummation, however, meaning life consumed in death, reaching that point of death. To die, to sleep, and now the thought kicks in, he can't help it, he's a thinker. To sleep, perchance to dream. And now he extends the comparison. Yes, we go to bed at night, we go to sleep. We lose consciousness. That's all there is to it. That's the end. But it's not oblivion. What happens when we sleep? There's that very active dream life. Things keep going. We think we're out of it, but no, there are all sorts of things that are happening in the dream that seem as if they are absolutely real. They are so real that while we're dreaming them, we believe them. It is the mystery of the dream world. And if we wake up again, then we wake up to reality, and that reality is very different from the dream world. Two nights ago, I had a long dream about my cat, who was my constant companion for 11 years. She died a year ago. I'm dreaming about my cat. It was vivid. She was there. I woke up, and I lost the cat for a second time. I had that moment of, oh, yeah, she's dead. She's been dead for a year. But in the dream, there was another existence, another reality. That life was there. It was real. But perchance to dream. So there is something more in sleep. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. Maybe death isn't the end. Please look, he's not talking any kind of theological vision, religious vision, catechetical vision. He is simply trying to sort out questions from ground zero, all belief having been shattered. And he's saying, we sleep, we dream. Maybe we die. Maybe there's something else like dream. Maybe there's something beyond that. Could be. And that must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. Okay? That's the reason a lot of people go on living. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time? And now we get the long list. Who would put up with this life? And here's what life is. The whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong. You're under the thumb of someone who's wronging you, and it just keeps going. It just keeps continuing. The proud man's contumely, okay? This arrogant person who's looking down on you. The pangs of despised love. There's an alternate reading. Some of you may have despised, okay? Either one is appropriate. Either love that is not valued, or love that turns to hate. And again, this is what we've been dealing with in his own love problems throughout the play. The pangs of despised love, the law's delay. Take me to court. See how long it lasts. Okay, see what you end up. The law's no solution to human problems. The insolence of office. I love it. Go deal with a bureaucrat. Go deal with someone who's in a public position. And the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes. That one who is indeed, who has merit, but has to face up to someone in a position of power who's totally unworthy, and you just put up with it. You just put up with it. You just put up with it. When, there we get the list. That's what life is like. When he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin. When he might finally put an end to it with a simple little dagger. We can get rid of all of that. It can end very simply. Who would fardels bear? Who would these burdens bear? Fardels, quite literally, big packs that are put on pack animals that a poor mule or a horse has to carry. Who would fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life? Who would put up with this but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose born no traveler returns, nobody's come back to tell us what it's like there. Please notice, he's doubting the ghost. The ghost claimed to come back and tell him. He's doubting the ghost. Everything is doubted. That's what's led him to this point. There's nothing that can be believed. Puzzles the will and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of. Yes, this is miserable, but if I kill myself, I may be in a worse place. And that's the only thing that holds me back. Thus conscience, and suddenly, why a worse place? Because I'm aware of all the things I've done that are wrong, and maybe after death, I'll be in some place. There is a hint, a tiny hint there, that there is a punishment on the other side of death. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all. And thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought. That's why I can't act. That's why I can't act. That's why action is impossible. But please note the action now. It's not action against Claudius. It's action against the self. It's not something externalized. It is internalized action. Not taking that sword, that dagger against Claudius or an external evil, but just being done with the self. The native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought. These thoughts make it impossible to act. And enterprises of great pitch and moment with this regard, their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. You cannot believe anything if you're living in fear and uncertainty. You can't do anything if you're filled with doubt. Hamlet can't act because you have to believe something to act. He can't even turn against himself because there's a possibility that there might be something else, but who knows? So what do? You stand paralyzed, not acting and only thinking, the thoughts going round and round and round, okay? Their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. We now know why he can't act. It's made explicit. He doesn't believe. He doubts everything. He even doubts the annihilation of death. He even doubts that death may be nothing. Well, I've got to doubt that too. Consumed by doubt. How do you define anything? How do you believe anything? How do you do anything? We're back to my initial statement that Hamlet is the first modern play. This is modern man who has lost his faith, but not just has lost his faith, doubts everything. And as a result, can't do anything. I don't think there's any getting around it. I'll come back to the point. This is the play in which Shakespeare gives voice clearly to something that was happening inside him. Hamlet is one of, I think, maybe two or three characters in all of Shakespeare's works where we get a sense of Shakespeare. And suddenly he was overwhelmed in this world in which he found himself. And this is the play in which he's nearly losing his balance. The certainties are going. The world is more than he can put up with. The society he is living in is corrupt. He doesn't know what to believe anymore. And he's giving voice to all of that. There seems to me little doubt that all of these thoughts going through the title character have come from somewhere. And if anywhere we get a sense of the playwright trying to work something out, it's here. But he's working it out in art. But this is shaky. This is we're on the verge of losing balance here. Who appears at that moment? Ophelia. Soft you now, the fair Ophelia. Nymph in thy horizons, be all my sins remembered. As you're praying, pray for me and all those terrible wrongs I have done. It's a hopeful moment. At least he acknowledges he has sinned. At least he hopes Ophelia will pray for him. He may not be able to pray, but he hopes she will pray. Good my Lord, how does your honor for this many a day? I humbly thank you well. And then she does again what her father has ordered her to do. My Lord, I have remembrances of yours that I have longed to redeliver. I pray you now receive them. And she hands back the gifts he sent. No, not I. I never gave you aught. They didn't come from me. I didn't send you anything. I didn't give you anything. My honored Lord, you know right well you did. And with them words of so sweet breath composed, as made the things more rich. Their perfume lost, take these again, for to the noble mind, whether 'tis nobler in the mind, she's echoing his words, for to the noble mind rich gifts wax poor when givers prove unkind. there, my Lord. Ha ha, are you honest? Please notice what happens at this moment. The scene descends into prose. Everything so far in the scene has been poetry. The long speech is poetry. Ophelia comes in, she's speaking poetry, and suddenly Hamlet attacks her, and we descend into prose. We're going down. And he is now taking it out. His own anger, his own rage, his own doubt, his own despair, his own questions. He's now taking it out on Ophelia. Who? The only innocent one in the court. Ha ha, are you honest, my lord? Are you fair? What means your lordship? That if you be honest and fair, your honesty should admit no discourse to your beauty. Could beauty, my lord, have better commerce than with honesty? Aye, truly. For the power of beauty will sooner transform honesty from what it is to a bawd than the force of honesty can translate beauty into its likeness. If you're beautiful, there's a good chance that beauty will corrupt you. Whereas honesty cannot translate beauty into anything honest. Beauty cannot be honest. Why? Beauty's external. All externals are to be mistrusted. This was sometime a paradox, but now the time gives it proof. I did love you once. Whew. Ah, it's just too sad to comment on. Indeed, my lord, you made me believe so. You should not have believed me. For virtue cannot so inoculate our old stock, but we shall relish of it. We're old, we're sinful, we're human. Don't believe anything anyone says. I loved you not. Where are we? We're back at these are wild and whirling words, my lord. He is losing it. I was the more deceived. Get thee to a nunnery. Why wouldst thou be a breeder of sinners? If you have children, you'll just have more, there'll be more sinners in the world. I am myself indifferent, honest, but yet I could accuse me of such things that it were better my mother had not borne me. I'm not a bad guy, but it's better I had never been born. This is awful stuff. He continues to rant. One quick line here. What should such fellows as I do crawling between heaven and earth? Stuck somewhere in the middle, not knowing what to do. And the image is of crawling. Not even walking, just crawling. Believe, we are errant knaves all. Believe none of us. Go thy ways to a nunnery. Okay, and then, where's your father? Now, it's not known, and it depends production by production. Does Hamlet see the king and Polonius spying on him? And is that why he's doing this? Or is this spontaneous, and his rage is just going at Ophelia, and he honestly doesn't know where Polonius is? Possibilities, okay. In any given production, you can only make one of those choices. You can't act out both of them. Marry a fool. Wise men know well enough what monsters you make of them. To a nunnery go, and quickly to farewell. And then we get a little prayer. Oh, heavenly powers, restore him. And then, this is right before Hamlet exits, his last speech before he exits. I have heard of your paintings, too, well enough. God hath given you one face, and you make yourselves another. He's talking about putting on makeup. It is similar to Claudius's remarks about the harlot's cheek. This is a pattern that's going to reappear throughout the rest of the play. The notion is what? Covering up what is there with an external beauty that's phony. And he is making that accusation against Ophelia, whom we can't imagine walking around wearing heavy makeup. But what's the point? It's again, that which is external is not to be believed, and he's not just attacking Ophelia, he is attacking all women. This is what you women do. So when he says, I have heard of your paintings too, it's not Ophelia's, it's all you women. You jig, you amble, and you lisp, and nickname God's creatures, and make your wantonness your ignorance. You do terrible things and pretend, oh, I don't know what I'm doing, okay. Go to, I'll no more on it. It hath made me mad. I say we will have no more marriages. Those that are married already, all but one shall live. The rest shall keep as they are. To a nunnery, go. He's gone. When Hamlet abuses Ophelia in that way, it is a mark of how low he has sunk. The good woman in Shakespeare is always, always connected to the spiritual health of the hero. In the comedies, when the heroes are wooing and trying to win good women, it's a mark of their mental health. And if it's not easy for them to do so and there are obstacles, the fact that they persist in order to win a good woman is a mark of something good in the man. A man who is pursuing a good woman is spiritually healthy. With the tragic heroes, when they trample on or reject good, decent women, it's a mark of what's happening to them inside. When Hamlet abuses Ophelia and rejects her, it's a mark that there's something wrong inside. When Othello begins accusing Desdemona and then kills her, it's a mark of what's happened to his own soul. When King Lear rejects Cordelia and banishes her, he is banishing his own mental health and spiritual stability. Macbeth isn't surrounded by lovely ladies. Macbeth has another problem, okay? But that union between Macbeth and his lady is again a mark of what the temptation to Macbeth's soul, and when he gives in to his wife, when he gives in to the witches, well, we know that there's not a lot of good that's going to follow from that. So this is standard. This is standard. Point I'm making, Hamlet's treatment of Ophelia is a mark of his own spiritual sickness. It's very clear. The moment he is gone, Ophelia returns to poetry and has her brief soliloquy that begins, "Oh, what a noble mind is here o'erthrown." She can't see into his soul, but she knows something is happening to his thinking. And it used to be a noble mind, and it's o'erthrown now. It's been tossed over. The courtiers, soldiers, scholars, eye, tongue, sword, the expectancy and rose of the fair state, the hope of Denmark. But notice the flower image. If Hamlet began using weed imagery, flowers are now going to be connected with Ophelia, and Shakespeare is already setting up that heartbreaking moment when she hands out flowers in her madness. He's connecting flower imagery with her, which again is healthy. There's something good in this young woman, in spite of what she's surrounded with. The glass of fashion and the mold of form, the observed of all observers, quite, quite down. And we can believe those words. Ophelia's a truth teller. This young man has gone quite, quite down. And I, of ladies most deject and wretched, that sucked the honey of his music vows, now see that noble and most sovereign reason, like sweet bells jangled out of tune and harsh, that unmatched form and feature of blown youth blasted with ecstasy. The image of blooming and blossoming, and it's been blasted by madness. This most reasonable young man. Oh, woe is me to have seen what I have seen. See what I see. Oh, it's glorious. It's glorious. And the king says, love? That didn't look like love to me. And he's right, because that love is gone. That love is gone, along with much else. I've got to go quickly. My goodness. All right, I can do this. Scene two, quickly. We begin with Hamlet speaking prose again. He's giving the advice to the players. It's wonderful. We should do an hour or two just on this, but we can't. We won't. But just in his saying, suit the action to the word to the action, he's calling for again something that is obsessing him. Interior, exterior should match. Words and action should be one. That's not the way it is in his life right now. But he needs to see that from the players at least. What should the players do? Hold the mirror up to nature. to show virtue her own feature, scorn her own image, and the very age and body of the time his form and pressure. Point being, there should be unity between art and what it is mirroring. Makes perfect sense. What is he longing for? He's longing for that unity, for that which is sensible. He goes on, I'm just going to run to one last thing right at the end, I love it. And let those that play your clowns speak no more than is set down for them. I love it. This again has got to be Shakespeare talking about his own theater experience. If you've ever dealt with people who are comedians, when you get them on stage, just look out, okay? They get a few laughs, and he clearly had been through this. He had worked with some men who were apparently great comic actors, but he must be very annoyed because they obviously went out and didn't just say what he had written for them. They're improvising, they're getting laughs wherever they can. This has got to be a little jibe directed at Will Kemp, who was probably, you know, maybe very well played the Gravedigger, one of the great comic actors, but saying, yeah, you're very funny, but you just say what I've written down for you. Don't start improvising, okay? For there be of them that will themselves laugh to set on some quantity of barren spectators to laugh too, though in the meantime some necessary question of the play be then to be considered. They'll just be going for laughs and forget the plot and forget what the play is about. However, please notice what he's saying is don't go overboard. Don't forget where you are, which is exactly what he himself is going to do during the play within the play. He has said he's going to let Claudius witness what went on, and you'll notice before the play and during the play, he can't keep his mouth shut. And in fact, what we're going to find is he's saying things he doesn't even necessarily know he is saying. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to need to go to this. He rises back to poetry in order to compliment Horatio. It's a beautiful speech. It is one of the great tributes to friendship ever penned. And if there's one thing that Hamlet can still hold on to at this moment, it is the friendship of Horatio. And he pays tribute to that friend. It's a lovely speech, but I can't do that. I've got to leap ahead. He's joking with Polonius as the play begins, and saying, you played once in the university, you say. That I did, my lord, and was accounted a good actor. What did you enact? I did enact Julius Caesar. I was killed in the Capitol. Brutus killed me. It was a brute part of him to kill so capital a calf there. That was very unkind of him to have done that. It's very funny for a couple of reasons. The actor who played Polonius in the original production had obviously just played Julius Caesar in Shakespeare's play. And Polonius is now joking, saying, well, I played Julius Caesar once, but Brutus killed me. Well, who would have played Brutus in Julius Caesar? The actor now playing Hamlet. And Hamlet says that was a brute thing of him to do. What's going to happen before the act is over? Hamlet is going to kill Polonius. The actor who played Brutus and who killed the actor who played Julius Caesar is now going to act, in acting the part of Hamlet, kill the actor who's playing Polonius. But we get a commentary on it by Hamlet before it happens. It was a brute part of him to kill so capital a calf there. It's going to be the action of a brute. Commentary being given before the action occurs. I need to leap ahead. We get the dumb show. The play within the play begins. Hamlet's talking all the way through it. He's commenting on the action. The king finally says, what do they call the play? Hamlet says, the mousetrap. Marry how? Tropically. It's a joke. Metaphorically, that's what it's called. But of course, there's a joke with trap. It's called the mousetrap. How? Tropically. This play is the image of a murder done in Vienna. Gonzago is the duke's name. His wife, Baptista. You shall see anon. 'Tis a knavish piece of work, but what of that? Your majesty, and we that have free souls, it touches us not. Let the galled jade wince, our withers are unwrung. The king is sleeping in the garden. He has said goodbye to his wife. And in comes, okay, and now Hamlet says, this is one Lucianus, nephew to the king. Wait a minute, what's wrong with this? If we're setting up a parallel for Claudius to see, the old king is sleeping in the garden, in comes the murderer who should be the brother to the king. But that's not what's on Hamlet's mind. The king's about to be killed. Who's going to do the killing? The nephew. He gives himself away. It's a slip of the tongue. He admits publicly the king is about to be killed by his nephew. He has overstepped his bounds and said too much. Just what he told the clowns not to do. He has given himself away. Claudius, if he's listening, should not just be made uncomfortable by what he's seeing, but what he just heard his nephew say. I've never seen an actor playing Claudius react to that. But it's, boy, there it is. This is one Lucianus, nephew to the king. And indeed, Lucianus pours the poison in the king's ear. And suddenly the king rises. What? Frighted with false fire? What? Scared by blank cartridges? This isn't real murder. This isn't a real cartridge. This is just a blank being fired. How fares my lord? Give order to play! And the king calls out, give me some light. The soul dwelling in darkness calls for light. And off he runs. And, of course, what we have is the excitement of the young man. He should not be excited. He has just misspoken and given away the game. He has just publicly admitted his plan to kill his uncle through a slip of the tongue. There is no indication that Hamlet himself is aware of what he has said. But he has clearly misspoken. And indeed, we might say, frighted with false fire is exactly what's happened. He's scared Claudius, but he has not done what he intended to do, which was let the play be played out, sit and observe Claudius and see how he takes it. He has been, as Ophelia says, like a chorus, interrupting, adding interjections, and finally giving the whole game away, and Claudius runs off, not just disturbed by what he's seen, but clearly disturbed by what Hamlet has said, that Hamlet seems to does not seem to understand he has even said. He has admitted that the nephew to the king is about to kill him. That's what he says. I'm not going through the scene with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. It is important, but the notion of what would you pluck out the heart of my mystery, he tweaks Polonius again, and Act 3, Scene 2 ends with that speech that Father Doran mentioned last night, which again is a low point for this character. He is out of control. 'Tis now the very witching time of night when churchyards yawn and hell itself breathes out contagion to this world. Now could I drink hot blood and do such bitter business as the day would quake to look on. This is not an ordered soul. Soft now to my mother. O heart, lose not thy nature. Remain who you are. Let not ever the soul of Nero enter this firm bosom. Nero who killed his own mother. But Hamlet is aware he is so ready to kill now. The play has hyped him up so that, yes, now he can kill. I just hope I don't kill Mom. Which is an indication of the confusion going on inside. And please notice, having rejected Ophelia, trampled on Ophelia, mistreated Ophelia, we have spiritual confusion of the highest order now. He's not thinking properly. He doesn't even know what he's going to do anymore. Let me be cruel, not unnatural. Let me go to my mother and be cruel, he says. Oh, that's a lovely thought. I will speak daggers to her, but use none. My tongue and soul in this be hypocrites. Whew. How in my words soever she be shent to give them seals, never my soul consent. I I'm running out of time, but I do need to do this quickly. What I mentioned earlier about Claudius beginning to open up, we see in the great prayer scene, he tries to pray. Please notice what's happening here. Hamlet is descending. Our vision of Hamlet should really be sinking. Our vision of Claudius is changing a bit too. This is not a cold-blooded, cold-hearted killer. This is a man with a conscience. And we look at his great soliloquy, Act 3, Scene 3, Claudius alone. Oh, my offense is rank. It smells to heaven. It hath the primal eldest curse upon it, a brother's murder. I have repeated that first murder, Cain killing Abel. It is the oldest curse in the world, and I've done it again, and I am cursed. Pray can I not, though inclination be as sharp as will. I really want to pray, but I can't do it. My stronger guilt defeats my strong intent. I'm too guilty to pray, but I really want to pray. And like a man to double business bound, I stand in pause wherein I shall first begin and both neglect. And now we have the king incapable of action. But what's the action he wants to take? Not like his nephew to go and kill. Sadly, he's already done that. The action he wants to take is prayer. But what prevents him is his own sense of guilt. Claudius is dealing at least honestly with his situation, his previous actions, and his current inclinations. It's not commendable, but he's thinking clearly. Is there not, what if this cursed hand were thicker than itself with brother's blood? Is there not rain enough in the sweet heavens to wash it white as snow? Is it not possible that rain from heaven can... We think back to the earlier play. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven. Claudius is echoing Portia there. Woo! Woo! Whereto serves mercy but to confront the visage of offense? What's the point of mercy if not to forgive guilt? But what's in prayer but this twofold force? To be forestalled ere we come to fall... Why pray? First, we pray so that we won't fall to temptation in the first place. We pray so that we won't do a wrong. We know we're capable of it. We pray to be prevented from it. So I should have prayed before the murder. I should have prayed that I not be tempted and that I not murder my brother. That's the first purpose of prayer. Or pardon being down. The second purpose of prayer, I should now kneel down and pray for pardon. Pray for God's mercy. Then I'll look up, he says. My fault is past. The murder is in the past. I should pray now, but oh, what form of prayer can serve my turn? Forgive me my foul murder. That cannot be, since I am still possessed of those effects for which I did the murder. I can't ask for forgiveness, because I've still got everything I gained from the murder. My crown, mine own ambition, and my queen. And he tells us why he did it. He wanted the crown, he wanted to satisfy his ambition, and he wanted to get Gertrude. And the murder got him all three. And now he can't kneel down and say, forgive me, because he's still holding on to all that stuff. May one be pardoned and retain the offense. In the corrupted currents of this world, offense's gilded hand may shove by justice, and oft is seen the wicked prize itself buys out the law, but 'tis not so above. You can play those tricks here on earth. You can get away with stuff here on earth, but 'tis not so above. Please notice, Claudius is a believer. The older generation is not afflicted with the doubt that the younger generation is dealing with. Hamlet doesn't know what's what. Hamlet doesn't know if there is anything beyond. Hamlet doesn't know if there is a heaven or a hell. Claudius knows. But in his corruption, he has brought about this evil state in which young Hamlet has to live. But 'tis not so above. There is no shuffling. There the action lies in his true nature, and we ourselves compelled, even to the teeth and forehead of our faults, to give in evidence. We got to tell the truth there. What then? What rest? Try what repentance can. What can it not? Yet what can it when one cannot repent? I can't repent yet because I want this stuff I've got. Oh, wretched state! Oh, bosom black as death! O rhymed soul that struggling to be free art more engaged, help angels. I'll tell you, at this moment, I feel sympathy for Claudius. At least he's a truth teller here. Make us say, bow stubborn knees, and hearts with strings of steel be soft as sinews of the newborn babe. Let my heart become innocent again. All may be well. And he kneels in prayer. Notice what's in Hamlet's mind. Now might I do it, Pat. Now he is praying, and now I'll do it. And so he goes to heaven. And so am I revenged. That would be scanned. A villain kills my father, and for that I, his sole son, do this same villain send to heaven? Oh, this is higher in salary, not revenge. He goes on thinking, no, I'll wait. When he is drunk asleep or in his rage or in the incestuous pleasure of his bed, at game, a swearing, or about some act that has no relish of salvation in it, then trip him, that his heels may kick at heaven and that his soul may be as damned and black as hell whereto it goes. Who is the more admirable character at this moment? My mother stays. This physic but prolongs thy sickly days, he says to Claudius. Goes off to his mother. The king rises up. A heartbreaking couplet here. My words fly up. My thoughts remain below. Words without thoughts never to heaven go. He's failed in his attempt to pray. He fails. But the character has grown, in a sense, because we've seen the struggle. I'm going to make this very simple because I'm running out of time. Act 3, Scene 4, is the moment of Hamlet's tragic choice. It's here that he has his tragic fall. It's very simple, it's very clear, it's direct, and I don't see confusion in this at all. The point I've been trying to make as we go through the third act is that his mind is confused, his soul is darkened. This is our hero at his low point. He is such a mess that he goes in to see his mother and he is nearly hysterical. He is out of control. Polonius is behind the curtain. He scares Gertrude because he's behaving in such a bizarre manner. And he's waving that sword around and she thinks he's going to kill her. We know he said, I don't want to kill Mom. I'm going to try not to kill her. But he is in such a state that there is indeed a very real question. And she calls out at the beginning of the scene, what wilt thou do? Thou wilt not murder me. Help, help, ho! And Polonius in fear calls out from behind the arras, and Hamlet says, how now, a rat? Dead for a ducat, dead, and shoves the sword into the arras. Polonius from behind the arras, I am slain, falls and dies. The queen, O me, what hast thou done? And Hamlet says, nay, I know not. Is it the king? His mother says, what have you done? And he says, I don't know what I did. Did I get the king? Who did I kill here? This is horrific. But it can be described very simply. If for the first 2.5 acts of this play, we have thought and no action, we now have a total reversal and have action with no thought. This most reflective and analytic of characters, the one who says, I got to do something, but I got to think about it a little more. And has thought and thought and thought and talked and talked and talked. Now finally does act without thinking. He has worked himself up into such a state that he simply takes an action and then requests information as to what he's done. Oh, I don't know what I did. Did I get the king? Nay, I know not. Is it the king? Oh, what a rash and bloody deed is this, Gertrude said. And she is right. Please notice, and this is, Claudius killed with clear motives. He knew what he was killing for. It was calculated, but he had a motive. Why has Hamlet killed Polonius? Well, because he had to kill somebody. He'd been talking long enough, and he was all souped up, and, well, there's somebody there. Bingo, I got somebody. Who did I kill? Ah, it is horrible. Oh, what a rash and bloody deed is this. A bloody deed, almost as bad, good mother, as kill a king and marry with his brother. Oh, don't talk about what I did. What did you do? Did she kill King Hamlet? No, she didn't. Did she marry his brother? Yes. Is that marriage worse than the murder Hamlet has just committed? Certainly not, and at this point he is doing what those who are guilty always do. Don't forget about me. What did you do? You're really bad. As kill a king, she says. What are you talking about? She has no idea. Aye, lady, 'twas my word. He lifts up the arras. Oh, it's Polonius. Thou wretched, rash, intruding fool, farewell. I took thee for thy better. Take thy fortune. Thou findest to be too busy as in some danger. You shouldn't have been hanging around here. You got yourself in trouble. This is our hero. He is heartless. He is thoughtless. He is insensitive. And the blood is now on his hands. The blood is now on his hands. What got him? A moment of anger, wrath. A moment of thoughtlessness, imprudence. And Hamlet has fallen. Please notice the ghost came to tempt Hamlet to kill Claudius. But whatever has happened here has been Hamlet's own doing. This is a tragic flaw. This is a tragic mistake. This is now a tragic fall. I don't need to go through the rest of the scene because what it is Hamlet telling Gertrude how awful she is and how she better shape up. It's a heartbreaking scene, but it's heartbreaking because in this it's clear he does still love his mother. She does feel guilt. There is a relationship. But I'm sorry, he has now become part of the rottenness of Denmark. It's touched him too. It's gotten him. He says goodnight and then simply says, for this same Lord, I do repent. It's offhand. Well, I'm sorry about this. But heaven hath pleased it so to punish me with this and this with me, that I must be their scourge and minister. I'm the scourge of heaven, so I had to kill this old guy. Now, Polonius is a real pain. And he's a blabbermouth, and he's foolish, and he's a spy, and he's a lackey to Claudius. But does he deserve death for that? Well, but there's no sense of that on Hamlet. Well, he deserved to die, and I had to do it. That was heaven's will. And then he goes back to his mother and says, don't go back to the king. I must be cruel only to be kind, he says. The bad begins and worse remains behind. And then the line I mentioned it before, here it is, he says, and I'm going to go after Rosencrantz and Guildenstern too, because I know they're up to something, but I'll get them too. And then he says, this man shall set me packing. I've got to take care of this somehow. I'll lug the guts into the neighbor room. This is our sensitive young man from Act One. Mother, good night. This counselor is now most still, most secret, and most grave, who was in life a foolish, prating knave. Come, sir, to draw toward an end with you. Mother, good night. We're at the low point, okay? And we'll leave him there for the weekend. You don't have to listen to me talk for over two whole days. You're very lucky. We'll pick up with Act 4 on Monday morning. I wish you a good weekend. Remember my sweet mother in your prayers. Her 75th birthday, I'll be celebrating. I'd appreciate prayers for her.